Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 077066, Christian Ware Appellant versus Navy Federal Credit Union et al. Ms. Martin, the appellant, Mr. Flint, Appellant, Mr. Delary LLC, Ms. Keating, and the Appellant, Navy Federal Credit Union.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. Sakari Hardnett for...
You'll probably have to speak up a little. Okay.
Sakari Hardnett for Mr. Muir.
Excuse me, ma'am. Is your microphone on?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Is your microphone on?
It appears to be on, Your Honor. Okay. The light is on.
You have to pull it closer to you. The head of it. Yeah.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Perfect.
Appellant filed an action in trial court against Navy Federal Credit Union, referred to hereinafter as a credit union, and a debt collection firm, Patricia L. Deering, which was also a law firm. Because they worked jointly and in concert to unlawfully take the monies that he deposited into his account to satisfy a debt which did not belong to him, Mr. Muir brought this action against the law firm and against Deering, the debt collector, and asserted his claims against the credit union for tortious conversion, breach of fiduciary duty, and tortious interference with his business expectancy. In his complaint, Mr. Muir requested an award of actual statutory and punitive damages, as well as attorney's fees and costs, pre- and post-judgment interest. The law firm initially filed a motion to dismiss the complaint on the grounds that the district court did not and could not exercise personal jurisdiction over it because it was a Louisiana-based company.
Counsel, we've read your briefs, and you may have noticed in our rules that we discourage strongly reading an oral argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just tell us what the case is about, what you think the major issues are. We've read the briefs.
Okay. Your Honor, Mr. Muir deposited funds in a credit union. The credit union took the funds and kept the funds for Mr. Muir for years. That's the reason why Mr. Muir filed lawsuit against the credit union and against the debt collector. Mr. Muir alleged that the debt collector violated his fair debt collection, violated the FDCPA.
The district court said he lacked standing. And what's your response?
Well, Your Honor, it's Mr. Muir's position that he did not, that he in fact did have standing. He is a consumer. He is entitled to not be harassed and not be subjected to abusive collection practices. And he believes that Deering engaged in those abusive collection practices. They participated with the credit union in removing the funds from the account. They participated with the credit union in holding the funds.
In other words, it's his allegation that the credit union said that they had cleared this through the law firm. Is that what he's relying on?
Well, Your Honor, he's relying upon the fact that the credit union informed him that Deering instructed them to withhold the funds, that they could legally withhold the funds.
So that's a yes to my question.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then let's see, on the breach of fiduciary duty against the credit union, the district court granted summary judgment. What was the error there?
Well, Your Honor, the district court granted some summary judgment alleging that there wasn't a breach of fiduciary duty.
And isn't his problem that the allegations are undercut by some of the evidence he offered in support in opposing the motion?
Your Honor, in the complaint, the allegations were alleged, and it's the appellant's position that he's not obligated to plead his whole case in his initial complaint.
Right, but he can't, if he opposes it and he contradicts his allegations, then he has a problem, doesn't he?
Your Honor, I don't believe that he contradicts the allegations in his opposition. What he claimed in his opposition is that Mr. Muir deposited the funds in the credit union, and as a result of depositing the funds, he in fact is an owner. Now, there is a position on the other side that he alleges that he was a member. He alleges that he was an owner. He does not allege that he was a member.
Doesn't his affidavit say he was never a member?
Your Honor, he was never a member. He was an owner. As a matter of fact, when the funds were, when the account was opened for Mr. Muir was a minor. His father opened the account and added Mr. Muir's, his son's name to the account. And all of the paperwork that was submitted by the credit union that we were initially able to obtain, none of those documents were signed.
What do you do about the, this is covered by Virginia law, right?
Yes, Your Honor, it is covered
well,
by.
Under Virginia law, a credit union is the same as a bank and neither has fiduciary responsibilities to the shareholders. What do you do about it? What do we do about that?
Well, Your Honor, we're not, in Virginia, the law is quite clear. Virginia says that if you are a multiple party account, a joint account, that you cannot take the funds, all of the funds in that account. You can
that's on the question of conversion. I'm on the question of what's on a violation of fiduciary duty. So the Pleasant versus Haynes case, which is a case about a shareholder who's in a federal credit union, the court says there's no fiduciary duty. What do you have a Virginia case that says that a credit union is different than a bank?
Well, Your Honor, the only case that we cited in our brief was the Fleming case, and the court was quite clear the Fleming
what
case.
What jurisdiction is the Fleming
it's
case?
It's a Virginia case, Your Honor, from the Virginia Supreme Court. And the Virginia case, it talks about a bank, and it talks about depositors in the bank. And it establishes Virginia law in reference to whether you can set off funds that are deposited in an account.
Again, that goes to the conversion question, not to fiduciary relationship.
Well, the fiduciary relationship is as an owner
but is there
in
a,
the account.
Is there a Virginia, you already won on conversion, right?
Yeah.
Pardon? You already won on conversion, correct? You won
yes,
conversion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So well, the not question total, not is. Not totally. You haven't totally won on conversion, have you?
Well, not in terms of the damages, no.
No, interest. Interest,
right.
Prejudgment interest.
And prejudgment
interest. On liability, you won, right?
That's correct.
So on fiduciary duty, is there a Virginia case that says that that a credit union has a fiduciary responsibility to somebody who's a shareholder by virtue of the fact that they put their money into an account?
Well, Your Honor, no. We drew an analogy from the Fleming case, which states that the bank does have a fiduciary duty
to Fleming says the bank has a fiduciary duty to whom?
To the depositors in the account. In other words, Your Honor, if the case that it cites is a husband and a wife, and the husband deposited funds and owed a debt, the bank set aside funds that were in the joint account that belonged to the wife. The wife brought the action alleging that the bank could not take the funds, that the bank could only use the funds that her husband deposited to satisfy his
again,
debt.
Again, doesn't that go to conversion, not to the question of whether there's a fiduciary relationship?
Well, Your Honor, the fiduciary, they have fiduciary duty to Mr. Muir as a depositor is they have a responsibility. If he's considered a part owner in the credit union, then he has a right to expect that the bank would give him accurate accounting and would act fairly in representing his interests. They did not do that. They took the money out of his account. It was a debt that he did not owe. And he has a right to file suit against them as an individual shareholder, as an individual owner, if his interests are separate and apart from the interests of the corporation.
You say you cited this case?
The Fleming case, yes, Your Honor.
I see you cited a Maryland case, but I don't see the Fleming case.
What's the name of the Fleming case? I don't see it in the table of authorities.
Okay. Yeah.
Your Honor, it's Fleming versus Bank of Virginia, I believe.
What is the site? Do you have a citation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It is a Maryland case. It's a Kiley case.
Okay. All right. So there's no Fleming case. All right. Let's move on here as to the tortious interference with business expectancy.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr.
Court said you failed to state a claim.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that we did state a claim, Your Honor. We cited Rule 8, which says that you do not have to prove your case. You basically have to give a clear statement of the facts, and Mr. Muir did that, a clear, concise statement of the facts and to support the claim. Mr. Muir did that. Mr. Muir also was a young entrepreneur. $27,000 was a lot of money to Mr. Muir.
What is the business relationship that was chilled?
Well, that's what I'm getting ready to express, Your Honor. Mr. Muir started a company, a construction company, and was using the $27,000 to work on a house, initially start the work on a house that he contracted to renovate for a homeowner. As a result of the bank taking those funds and holding those funds, Mr. Muir could not fulfill his obligations under that contract. And as a result, he lost that business and several other businesses, several other contracts that he had lined up.
Right, but we're at the failure to state a claim. And the question is, what was in your complaint? Now, all of that wasn't in your complaint. And the question is, did you allege enough to state a claim?
Your Honor, Mr. Muir believes that he did allege enough in his complaint to state a claim.
Because?
Your Honor, the Connolly case is quite clear in that all you have to do is give a precise statement of the facts in your complaint. You don't have to.
The Supreme Court has modified Connolly a little to say, you know, it can't just be sort of a speculative claim.
Your Honor, it was not speculative. He laid out that he had business expectations, he had contracts.
So
he informed
under Rule 8, it's enough to say, I have a business expectancy and your conduct interfered with it. I mean, that's what he said, right?
Yes, Your Honor, he did say that.
Did he say any more?
Your Honor, basically, I think in the beginning of the complaint, he stated that he expressed to the credit union that he had businesses, that he needed the money to do the work, and he was dependent upon the money, and that it would pose a real hardship upon him if he did not receive those funds.
Okay. And going back to Judge Silberman's point about your damages request.
Yes, Your Honor, we requested the court granted, recognized that there was, in fact, conversion, and ordered the credit union to return the funds to Mr. Muir, but they did not address the issue of damages. And therefore, Mr. Muir, they held Mr. Muir's money for several years, did not give him, return the money to him, but there was no interest on it. Even if he deposited the money in his account, it would have drawn some interest. Not only that, I mean, it sends a clear.
The district court said he denied it because you failed to provide supporting evidence. And I think your brief says you submitted the schedule that the district court requested, and yet he said you didn't submit evidence.
And, Your Honor, not only that, in the hearing before the district court, after this court remanded the case back to the district court, Mr. Muir brought a witness to the courtroom and asked the judge for permission to have the witness testify and to also have Mr. Muir testify. And the court denied that, would not allow it.
With respect to which issue? Are you talking about the prejudgment interest, or are you talking about other aspects of damages?
I'm talking about the damages associated with the conversion, Your Honor, and the business expectancy.
The lost profits.
Your lost profits. Yes.
How about punitive damages? Do you think you alleged enough for punitive damages?
Your Honor, I believe that we did allege enough for punitive damages. Mr. Muir expressed to them early on that he needed to have the funds returned to him. The credit union stated.
You have to show a lot more for punitives.
Well, Your Honor, but we were never able to do any discovery.
But this is an allegation here.
It was an allegation, Your Honor, but we were never able to do any discovery. The court denied us the ability to do discovery in this case.
Counsel, isn't it a fact that the problem here for the credit union was that they couldn't produce the signed document which would have waived, whereby the depositor or member would have acknowledged the bank's right of set off?
Your Honor, they didn't, the limited documents that we received from them.
Well, perhaps you should answer my question. Wasn't the problem for the credit union that they couldn't find the document that which normally members of the credit union would sign, which would allow the bank to set off on a joint account?
Your Honor, they may have alleged that that was a problem with them. We don't know. Like I said, we were never able to really engage in discovery. They produced some documents, but the documents that they produced were unsigned documents.
That's
so
the
we
point.
Don't
the point is that the bank failed to come up with the proper documents. Isn't that correct?
That's correct,
if
Your
they
Honor.
Had come up with the proper documents, what they would have done would have been legal, right?
Your Honor, if they come up with the proper documents, but I don't know that it's
so
possible.
So they were stuck because they didn't come up with the proper documents.
Precisely, but Your Honor, I don't know.
But is that on its face a grounds for punitive damage?
Your Honor, Mr. Muir was a child when his father put his name on that account.
So there were no documents.
Pardon?
There wasn't. It's not that they didn't find a signed document. It's that there was no signed document.
They didn't have the documents in the first place, Your Honor. So that's why we believe that they couldn't produce them. But, Your Honor, there are a lot of things that we don't know because we couldn't engage in discovery. And we believe that when Mr. Muir went to the credit union and he told them, I need to deposit this money, but I need to have immediate access to it, the credit union got on the phone, they pulled up the information, they saw that there was a set aside on that account. They got in touch with the debt collector, and the debt collector instructed them on what to do. They told Mr. Muir that these funds will be available in 2 days. Come back to the bank, and we'll give you the funds in 2 days. Never at any point did they inform Mr. Muir that those funds would not be available. Never at any point did they inform Mr. Muir that those funds would be set aside. That information, this is a computerized age, that information had to be available when they looked at his account and to determine if they could deposit those funds into that account. And they did not inform him of that. They withheld his money. He's a young man. He had a family to support. He had businesses. And maybe to some people, $27,000 is not a lot of money. But to everyday ordinary citizens, it is a lot of money.
Correct you. For federal judges, it's a lot of money.
why don't we hear from Appley here?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is Justin Flint, and I represent Appellee Patricia L. Deering, LLC. It's the argument of my client that this court should affirm the trial court's January 4, 2007 ruling below because there simply is no standing in this case against the debt collection agency. Plaintiff hasn't alleged anything in its June 2003 complaint.
He alleges that he was told by the credit union officials that they had cleared this.
That's correct.
The Deering law firm.
The allegation in the complaint, Your Honor, is that there are some nebulous conversations that were told.
No, it's not nebulous. He makes this allegation. All right, and for purposes of standing, we have to take the allegations as true.
Right. You can also take a limited investigation to see whether or not standing is appropriate, see whether or not there is the irreducible three minimums.
Well, I don't understand why this is a standing question.
You're not right. Is this Article 3 or prudential? Which
right.
is it?
This is the I want to address both, Your Honor.
Well, let's start with the Constitution. Do you understand that our cases make clear that when you make a constitutional standing claim, we assume that the plaintiff is correct on the law?
I understand. Right?
So if the plaintiff is correct on the law that she can recover, that he can recover under the federal statute, then I don't understand what the constitutional question is. There's no doubt that there's an injury, and if he is correct that he can recover under this statute, then it's redressable, and there's causation because of the allegation that that your client participated in the wrongful in the unfair practices.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I believe that with regard to the second and third prongs isn't present in this case. As Judge Leone set forth in his February 28, 2005 opinion, there's no causal nexus that can directly trace the injury in fact of the conversion.
The allegation is that your client participated in the unfair practices, and that's the cause. And the legal allegation is that the statute provides a relief for those unfair practices. Now, that may be wrong.
If we're going to talk about, Your Honor, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, saying it doesn't apply to Christian Muir, the son of Patrick Muir, for two reasons. One is he's not a consumer, as alleged by the appellant.
First of all, I don't understand why he's not a consumer. He is
not a consumer, Your Honor, because he's not a person that was obliged to owe a debt. If you look at the record,
that's not the definition of consumer. It's anyone who is allegedly obligated.
Right. We didn't allege
to pay any debt. Right.
The debt collection agency never alleged that Christian Muir was obligated. All the correspondence in the record, I can point
you
to the father. The father's not here.
It's not the father's money.
We never let the credit.
He put the money into the bank after the debt was owed and after the bank had already charged off the debt, right? Then he put the money into the bank, right? And that money was then taken.
The purpose of the act is to protect against abusive collections practices.
Now you're talking about a prudential. You're talking about a prudential standing, not a constitutional standing.
But I'm coming back to the definition of consumer. The law firm never alleged that Christian Muir owed.
It doesn't say who has to allege it. It doesn't say, this is done in the passive tense. It doesn't say that the defendant has to have alleged it.
Well, who would have alleged it? The only one that alleged it was the law firm. That's the allegation from the.
Well, if he didn't have to pay, then you have to give the money back. So there must be some allegation by someone that he had to pay. Right? His money was used to pay a debt. He put money into the bank.
On page 213 of the record, Your Honor, you have the bank just taking the money on October 17th of 2002.
Yeah.
The same day, the letter goes from the law firm seeking for $43,000. Clearly, it's inconsistent that they were on the same page with regarding the set-off of the money.
It's a factual dispute. This isn't a standing.
Counsel, let's assume you're wrong, or the court's wrong, the district court's wrong on Article 3. How can you still prevail?
I believe that the federal courts have provided guidance that the only way for someone to prevail, a non-debtor plaintiff, is to either show that they were somehow receiving the injurious conduct or that they could stand in the shoes of the debtor.
Wait, counsel, follow with me. I don't know whether you're making a prudential standing argument or you're making a cause of action argument. Which is it you're making?
I'm addressing.
Let's assume, arguendo, that we disagree on the Article 3 question.
I understand, right? Your Honor.
Now, are there grounds in this case to affirm the district judge on any other ground presented below?
Right. I believe the prudential zone of interest argument that you're talking about.
First of all, you have to tell me what you presented below. What arguments did you present below besides Article 3?
The arguments that were there's no standing are 12b-1, and the court could look at the appropriate extra pleading documents to see that there's no standing for Christian Muir to bring a lawsuit against the Deering Law Firm as being the son non-debtor.
Are you now moving to prudential standing?
No. There's two different questions, Your Honor.
Yeah, counsel, are you with me? I'm trying to get beyond Article 3, okay? We think it looks like the panel doesn't agree with you and the district court with respect to Article 3. Now, put it aside.
Okay.
Now, what other grounds do you have that you presented below or which we can consider on our own which would allow you to prevail in this court on this for your client?
We filed a motion to dismiss under 12b-1 for lack of standing, Your Honor.
Was that the only motion you filed?
That was the only motion we filed.
Okay.
So now you have to go to prudential standing, right?
That's right. And I believe that Siberski 2, which was addressed by the Second Circuit in 2005, addresses what are the appropriate limitations for a non-debtor plaintiff. Now, I understand the court may disagree with our version of what is a consumer. But still, for a non-debtor plaintiff to show...
Just to be clear, that's a Southern District of New York opinion, not a Second Circuit opinion.
Actually, Your Honor, it's the appeal from the Southern District of New York opinion that we cited in our brief. It's in the Second Circuit. It's in 2005. The case below was 2000. It was Siberski 1, which is in the Southern District.
The unpublished opinion? Is that
If it's unpublished, Your Honor, I wasn't aware, but I have a copy of the opinion. The Second Circuit.
Rulings by summary order do not have precedential effect. That's right. What it says right on the top of the opinion.
Well, for guidance of the court, yeah, well, if that's what it says, Your Honor, I take your word for it.
You don't have to take, you can come up and look at the word.
No, I take, okay. But that was the appeal of the...
That's very gracious of you to take.
Anyway, it's our still our position. This court
should affirm. All right, so you would start to say the non-debtor plaintiff.
The non-debtor plaintiff has two ways that you can judicially limit the scope of any, with respect to any person under the statute. And either you have to be able to somehow stand in the shoes or have the ability to open the mail of the debtor.
Let me ask you, imagine that you sent a letter to my bank and you said that I owed money and I didn't. That my money was Mr. Muir's money. The debtor was Mr. Muir, but the money in my bank belonged to Mr. Muir.
Right.
And say my bank paid. You're saying I would now have a claim against you, even though I'm neither the alleged debtor, even though I'm not the alleged debtor?
Under your scenario, Your Honor, you would be the alleged debtor because
would
have been
I'm saying
your
that
funds.
You send a letter to my bank right. saying that Mr. Muir is the debtor, but that the money in my bank belongs to Mr. Muir.
Right.
And you're not saying that I'm Mr. Muir, and you're not saying that I'm the debtor. You're saying I'm holding Mr. Muir's money.
I'm saying that you weren't the recipient of an abusive debt collection practice. And that's what the Congress and the Ninth Congress meant to protect with this, not for anyone under the sun to sue. So we respectfully request this court affirm the trial court's decision below that there is no standing given this. Mr. Muir never received any communications whatsoever from the law firm. Hasn't alleged any to receive any communications
indirectly.
With the law firm. He's
alleging indirectly.
If you look at the complaint, Your Honor.
Saying under the statute, let's give me this hypothetical. Suppose you were really an unscrupulous group and you advised the credit union, although there's no legal right to reach the plaintiff's funds, grab them, and we'll help you, we'll defend you, and we'll claim that it's that the money is really, the debt is his, even though we know it's not. You could not, under those circumstances, be sued?
I think the cause of action would be more of common law, not under the third debt collection
practice. I'm asking under the federal statute.
No, I don't believe that would be grounds for that, because there needs to be some sort of communication regarding collection of a debt to the consumer or the non-debtor plaintiff. And
but even if you're indirectly, if you
yeah.
tell the bank to do that, then that's the communication?
I believe that they still have to receive the communication. And that's
right. Unless the individual receives a communication from you. But they did was there any communication from you to the plaintiff in this case?
The plaintiffs can see in page 247 that they haven't received any direct communications from the law firm. So it's all about whether or not there's nebulous, in my opinion, communication, and they haven't offered anything in the complaint.
That goes to the cause of action, really, not to the standing issue. That's why I'm getting confused.
For standing, Your Honor, you need to have some sort of communication or recipient of a debt collections problem.
That's not. It doesn't say it must be a face-to-face, personal, direct communication. And in Judge Silverman's hypothetical, what you're asking the court to say, even for that type of hypothetical, that the statute would not apply, that plaintiff was not within the zone of interest that Congress was concerned about as being victimized by unscrupulous debt collectors.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that Congress intended to prevent abusive debt collection practices.
So in other words, this statute doesn't apply no matter how nasty you are, no matter how criminal or vicious your scheme is, as long as you don't actually communicate with the alleged debtor.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe the Congress...
How can that be right? You're talking about only one section of the statute.
Yes.
He charges, among other things, you violated 1692F.
Right.
Now, I'm reading this case that we're not supposed to read because it says not to be used. And it does not apply to Section F. It applies to the section of the statute relating to communications. So how do you win on Section F?
Again, I believe that the intent of the Act was, if you look at the 95th Congress, was to prevent communications or practices that were directed towards consumers.
F is not about communications.
Said practices.
Yes, unfair practice. I'm aware of what Your Honor is talking about.
I don't understand
about.
Why my hypothetical wouldn't be an unfair practice under this statute.
The plaintiff hasn't set forth what enumerated provision under Section F applies in this case, Your Honor, but assuming what you're saying is true, in theory, I would concede perhaps it could be under Section F, but they haven't set forth with any kind of specificity.
Well, that goes to cause of action, doesn't it?
It goes to standing, Your Honor. They haven't said how they can connect the injury in this case to the conduct of the defendant. They have just an allegation that there was indirect communication. We believe that they have to set forth more in order to invoke federal court jurisdiction.
All right, let me ask you, assume that we're at the question of whether the complaint states a cause of action under the statute. All right, so we're still looking at the allegations in the complaint. Is it your position that even if this court were to disagree with you on standing, that the court has to affirm because there are no allegations in the complaint sufficient to state a cause of action under the statute?
We believe that there are two different issues within that, Your Honor, if I may. There's a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act allegations, which are what they are. There's also an allegation that we are somehow involved in the conspiracy, involved in the conversion. In the argument of the appellant, they said that there's liability found for them for conversion, but they allege against both defendants. And actually, the court only found against the bank. In this case, there's no evidence whatsoever. And we believe that within the four corners of the complaint, there also would be an argument under 12b-6 to dismiss it on the grounds of conversion. But as to the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, Your Honor,
what about
it's for
the
standing.
Allegations of false representation? Does that reach your client?
If you're taking as true the fact that there was some indirect communication which hasn't been specified, it would have, yeah.
So that aspect of the complaint would suffice. All right.
Was your client held for the conversion also, or is that only the bank?
No, that's what I was addressing. Yeah. They just allege against the defendants in the bank.
With respect to the district court only held with respect to the bank.
That's correct, Your Honor. So, in closing, we respectfully request this court affirm the trial court's decision below that there lacks standing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from Appellee, the credit union.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kirsten Keating for Appellee Navy Federal Credit Union. Your Honor, I rather than go through the facts or anything like that, but I would like to point out one matter that I think is significant, which Judge Silberman actually brought up when he was speaking with the appellant's counsel, which is that on the conversion claim, they're on cross motions for summary judgment, and Mr. Muir prevailed because for the simple fact that the credit union was unable to present a signed copy of the document. The documents did provide the credit union with the right of set off. This isn't a case for punitive damages. The facts, as the district court found, it was a technicality.
I'll leave aside the technicality. You're not appealing the conversion, right?
No.
Okay. So as of what day was the money wrongly taken, according to the district court, then? The day that you took out the money. The day that you stopped him from being able to take out his money, right?
Right.
Okay. Under what theory would you not owe interest from then on? I guess I'm having a little difficulty understanding that. This is somebody who deposited money in a bank account, and then the bank, how many years later, gives them the money back? How many years later?
I believe it was, I don't know off the top of my head, Your Honor.
3 years, 4 years, 5 years?
A year.
Huh?
I
years.
Well, during all that time, the bank was earning interest on the plaintiff's money. On what theory? I understand there are lots of cases where there might be arguments about whether interest is owed. But in this case, which is the classic situation of somebody giving money to a bank and expecting to earn interest, and the bank, in fact, earning interest by loaning out the money, under what theory could a district court refuse to order interest paid on that debt, on that converted bank account?
Well, Your Honor, I think here the conversion claim was decided on cross motions for summary judgment. Mr. Muir had the burden with respect to damages. Neither in his motion or his affidavit that he supported in support of his motion did he say anything.
Talk about interest. He asked for interest. The district court's explanation is not that he didn't prove that something about interest, but that he didn't give a reason why interest should be owed. What reason would you have to give?
Your Honor, he didn't say anything about interest
in
his motion for summary judgment.
In his schedule, he gave the rate of interest and the period of time he was seeking interest for.
Yes, but the conversion claim was decided on the cross motions for summary judgment. At that point, it had been fully briefed, and
the district court proceeded to ask for a schedule of damages, and he identified the amount he was seeking in interest. I mean, what did he fail to show the district court, given all that Judge Garland
If I understand
you,
excuse me,
relayed.
I apologize. If I understand your theory, he has to explain his reason for asking for interest?
Well, he didn't even in his...
No, counsel, just try to get the law. Your view is he asked, it's understandable, it's acceptable, he asked for interest. Your view is he had to give a reason for asking for interest. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. He didn't give any explanation for...
No. He asked for interest, but your theory is he had to give a reason for it. Now, what's wrong with...
Well, no, Your Honor, that's not my theory. My theory is that he didn't say on this cross... He didn't ask. He didn't put an amount. The only amounts of damages...
Let's cut through, counsel. Isn't it perfectly clear that under the law he's entitled to interest?
Your Honor, the interest award of interest is within the clear discretion of the trial court. He hasn't presented any argument here as to how the trial court abuses discretion.
This is one of these cases where the thing speaks for itself. You put money in, you took his money, you kept his money, you gave it back to him years later.
What grounds?
What more does he have to say?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's a discretion question, but isn't it patently obvious that it would be an abuse of discretion not to award interest in a case such as this? What case ever has not awarded interest in a case like this?
Your Honor, I don't have a cite for you on
that. Yes, but isn't it fair to say that it's almost inconceivable that you wouldn't award interest in this kind of case?
What about lost profits?
No, but can I just finish on the interest? Would you agree on the interest point?
He wants a concession, counsel.
If you can give me an argument why, on the law, a district judge can refuse interest in this case, in this kind of case, I'd like to know what it is.
Your Honor, the only thing I can say that is I believe it's in the discretion of the court. He did not set forth anything as to the amount of interest he was seeking.
Who, he, the district judge?
Mr. Muir. The only damages he sought, in his affidavit, he says it three times, they took $27,000. He's presented no evidence.
Now, that is not the argument the district court relied on, right? The district court said at page 316, plaintiff has provided no explanation or argument in support of the award of this of interest. He didn't say that there wasn't evidence. Yeah. The district court allowed the plaintiff to file the schedule of damages, and he said there was no explanation. What explanation should somebody have to give to expect to get interest on his bank account?
Your Honor, I don't have an answer to that. All right. I apologize.
And what about the lost profits?
With respect to lost profits, again, Mr. Muir didn't present any evidence with respect to lost profits. He only sought the $27,000. For lost profits, he has to show proximate cause. He doesn't present anything. His schedule damages.
In response to his argument, he's entitled to discovery on that point. Your response was, wait a minute, this is information you have. What good is discovery on this? Why do you need discovery?
Exactly, Your Honor. And in fact, in his brief, he says, in discovery, I can be deposed. I will then present supporting documentation.
But his argument, as I understand it, is the district court said, submit a schedule of the damages you're seeking. There is no statute or court rule that elaborates on what the schedule must contain. And the district court didn't elaborate. So counsel for the plaintiff submitted a schedule, all right, and then the district court proceeded to deny the request on the grounds that it didn't have certain information in it. Yet where was there any indication that such information had to be included in the schedule? I mean, that's what I'm trying to understand this case.
Well, I think, again, Your Honor, the issue was fully briefed on the cross motions for summary judgment.
On liability.
No, with respect to damages as well.
But the way the district court tried the case, that's not the way he proceeded. He didn't say, having ruled on the summary judgment, the case is over. He said, submit a schedule of damages.
Well, he asked for a schedule of damages as to the additional damages that Mr. Muir was seeking. However, the issue of damages had been determined on cross motions for summary judgment. In fact, this court remanded the case so that rulings could be entered with respect to the additional damages. There was no requirement of additional evidence because everything had been fully briefed. Mr. Muir presented
his. Remand, the district court vacated its previous judgment, called for submissions, et cetera. I mean, he went further maybe than the remand required, but we're dealing with what he did on the remand.
He also didn't say what you're saying. That is, in his order on May 20th, 2007, he didn't say the failure was at the summary judgment stage. He didn't say that. He said, all they've given me now is a schedule of damages. But in fact, there was a status hearing on that schedule of damages, and at that status hearing, the plaintiff had with him a witness who would testify, who proffered would testify, that there was a business expectancy, that they were going to flip this house, and that X amount of money would be paid. And the district court wouldn't permit that.
Your Honor, Mr. Muir's counsel says that now. There was no proffer of evidence.
Well, let me read to you the proffer of evidence, okay? It's in the transcript of the status hearing, which, for a reason I don't understand, is not in the joint appendix. It's dated February 6, 2007. And it says, Mr. Muir had several opportunities that were, Mr. Muir, as I mentioned earlier, buys property, and because he is able to put down a certain amount of money, he doesn't have to go through a lot of documentation. He can get a no-doc loan. Mr. Muir had several opportunities that were lined up, and we have a witness here today, Your Honor, with several opportunities that were lined up so that he could purchase the property. It's flipping the property. With the $27,000, Your Honor, he already engaged in an agreement with a young woman whose property was in foreclosure. He agreed to get the property, to invest the property, to get the property out of foreclosure, to make repairs to the house, to put the house on the market, to sell the house.
Okay.
And he expects to make $30,000 in profit. Now, isn't that a proffer?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court did look at the entire record. It wasn't simply based on that hearing. He did look at the previous motions, which had already been fully briefed on cross motions for summary judgment.
All right. Any further point you'd like to make?
Did you produce evidence to the effect that the normal practice of the credit union was to have a depositor sign, joint depositor sign, such a document that you couldn't find?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you put evidence to the effect that it was the normal practice of the credit union when there was a joint account to provide or require that the depositor sign a document whereby allowing the bank to set off against the law, against a debt?
No, Your Honor. I think we made the argument in our motion for summary judgment
that
we should have prevailed on conversion because we were permitted to set off the funds. However, we didn't have the signed document, which was the reason that we were.
No, but did you even argue? Did you state what your normal practice was?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So why is the key whether that you couldn't produce the signed document if you don't even ask for the signed documents?
Well, Your Honor, we did say in our motion that this was a situation where Mr. Muir and his father, they opened the account when Mr. Muir was a minor. What the credit union didn't do is when Mr. Muir came of age majority, they didn't go back to him and say, now you sign the document. Obviously, he couldn't have signed it as
a counsel,
minor.
I'm trying to understand what the normal practice of the credit union is. Is the normal practice to ask to have someone, the depositor, sign such a document whereby the bank is allowed to set off against a loan?
Yes, Your Honor. When they sign the joint account agreement provides that the shares are belong to both members who are joined on the account.
All right. And that's the document you couldn't find?
Well, the document we attach a copy of that document. We just don't have the signed document. Yes.
Yeah, all right, so that is your normal practice.
Yes.
The only thing that was wrong here is you couldn't find a signed document.
That's right, Your Honor.
But your normal practice was to produce such a to require the depositor to sign such a document, which would have allowed you to set off.
That's correct, Your
Honor. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Well, then, isn't your argument then that as a matter of law, it's impossible to award punitive damages in this case? As a matter of law?
Yes, Your Honor.
It was reasonable for you to assume, since you do that all the time, that everybody who signs on here has signed the agreement. Everybody who deposits money has signed on. Maybe you made a mistake in this case, but given that that's your regular practice, it couldn't have been malicious to refuse to read it otherwise.
That's exactly it, Your Honor.
His argument, though, is that it may be your regular practice, but that regular practice did not occur here, and that although your client was told that exactly all we've been through, you could not find any such document because it didn't exist, and it was his money, it was not his debt, and nevertheless you took the money and continued to take the money, and that's enough to show punitive damages. Why is the plaintiff incorrect?
The plaintiff is incorrect because to obtain punitive damage, he has to show malice or some conscious disregard of his rights. But here the credit union was...
Conscious disregard of his rights.
Here the credit union was doing what it normally would do.
Right, and it hadn't done it in this case, and it knew it hadn't done it in this case. So why is that not conscious disregard?
It knew it hadn't done what, Your Honor?
It knew that it didn't have his signature on a joint account.
No, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that the credit union looked...
But he was a minor, and you had the burden to produce a document, and you couldn't produce it.
At the time when the funds went, he's no longer a minor.
Yes, but you never got him to sign the document.
We haven't been able to produce the document. I don't know for sure whether he signed the document or not, but we don't have a copy of the signed document.
I know that. And so why, when you have the information that he, and that you don't bring forth evidence to dispute it, that you were fully aware of his legal rights against set off, and nevertheless you set off and took his money for a debt he didn't owe?
There is no evidence and no allegation that we knew at the time that we set off the debt that we didn't have a signed document.
Ah, all right.
Just on that, can't a parent sign for the minor, including the agreement for the set-off?
When he's a minor, but when he becomes age of majority.
And it's no good anymore?
Our practice is to have it re-signed.
Just one more question on the fiduciary duty part. You don't know of any case that's ever held that a credit union is different than a bank with respect to fiduciary duty, do you?
No, Your Honor. In fact, we did cite in our brief one case that was out of the Northern District of Iowa, I believe, but that was in the credit union context, and they found that the relationship between a credit union and a member is the same as a bank and its depositor or customer, and it's a creditor-debtor relationship. And in fact, Mr. Muir, in his complaint, alleges that it was a creditor-debtor relationship.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel for the plaintiff, I'll give you 1 minute.
Your Honor, we do not need additional time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Court, we'll very much for its time and attention.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.